All right, the countdown is on to next week's NFL draft. Here to help us navigate the wagering landscape, draft expert Ron Marmolewski. Ron has more than 3 decades of experience producing NFL draft content. You can follow him on the platform formerly known as Twitter, at Ron Ace Sports. Ron, you made a strong Props and Hops debut last year to kick off the Plug and Play NFL draft betting series. Thanks for running it back with me this year. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, as always, Matt, for having me. I enjoy any kind of conversation with you, whether it's the props or whether it's the hops. And this is draft season. It's kind of my second season. I'm football only. And so this really drives me during the break between the actual action. So I'm revitalized for right now. And then in the summer, I can go downturn a little bit.
Yeah, you and me both finding this revitalizing, champing at the bit for draft day to arrive. And to those of you watching with us live on YouTube and Twitter, if you're eager as well, feel free to jump in the chat with any questions or comments. We will work that into the show where possible. Ron, I already see a comment from our mutual friend, Dan Rivera, welcoming back Props and Hops to the live streaming side of things after not doing so much of that since the week leading up to the Super Bowl. Dan, thank you for being with us this evening. And Ron, with that, let's get this show on the road. A lot of good ground to cover, as you alluded to, when it comes to both the props and the hops. Definitely more of a props focus for the purposes of this conversation. And to kick things off, I have the thought that, as the saying goes, the only constant is change. And maybe that's not necessarily a good thing for the NFL draft betting market, where it may imply that the glory days of 2020 to 2022 might not return in terms of the variety of options and the amount of liquidity across the marketplace. Nevertheless, Ron, opportunity is almost always knocking for those who are willing to listen closely enough. So to that end, how have you noticed, as you've gone through your process, how the draft market has perhaps evolved a little bit in this 2024 cycle?
What do we have? About 38 states now where it's legal to actually wager. And the more states we have, the less betting options we have with the draft, and the more scared the books are running, in my opinion. You see some props that are coming out late. You see changes rapidly. They're really afraid to go beyond the first 8, 9, 10 picks. They won't even put up who the fourth pick of the draft might be or who the fifth pick in some circles. So it's a little bit confusing to me. But on the plus side, what was it, 2 days ago that Circa came out with 48 props to start with, over under a player position, and included more than the first round, which are the ones that I kind of like the best, more than the first round, because somebody like me, who thankfully you made me seem younger than I am, because you only said 3 decades of draft recaps and analysis and stuff like that. But I feel that because I've handicapped the full draft, that I might have a handle on the second, third, fourth round and those kinds of things. So I miss the days when more of these props were out. But Circa did a great job with that. They've added some more since then. The downside, Matt, is that we live in California and you have to rely on others to get into Circa. And by the time that I connected with a couple of people, some of the numbers were gone. But it's still good for the prop market to see Circa get involved.
And Ron, correct me if I'm off base in that comment that you have more than 3 decades of NFL draft content production experience. I want to make sure I'm getting things right. And to build on your comments to that first question, in the spirit of getting things right, one thing that hasn't really changed as much as the market can evolve, this is still arguably as much of an information-driven market as there is across all of betting. And when I think of trusted sources, 3 names come to mind for me: Daniel Jeremiah, Peter Schrager, Dane Brugler, probably household names in draft betting circles. Ron, any thoughts on your end when it comes to these three or anybody else whose information moves the needle when it comes to your own approach?
Dane is a real up-and-comer in this, and I'm going to be hopefully focusing on that a little bit more. Dan and I suggested a possible show format based on some of the work that Dane's doing. He helps me fill in the gaps in a lot of areas because I do all my own work, but I don't have everybody's bench time, that bench press that didn't go to the combine. I don't have the actual breakdown at how many games they started at left tackle versus right tackle. And he has such an easy to read thing. I'd recommend that to anybody. Peter Schrager, I'm aware of his draft, but most of the mocks that I look at have nothing to do with ESPN or NFL.com or something like that. I listen to Daniel Jeremiah's analysis of some of the players, and he's going to deal mostly with first round players. And I find him to be pretty insightful, but that's kind of not the way that I go. I really go off the radar. I go to the beat writers. I go to, there's a guy named Bob McGuinn who's out there. He's been out there for years. It's behind a paywall now, but he produces a top 100 list that I recommend people to go to if you're looking at names for people. And Steelers Depot, if you're familiar with that, I tweeted that out in the past. They have extensive film work and analysis. I mean, they would fill 3 or 4 pages per person, and they do it on 150 or so players. They're quite transparent about it, and it's an excellent resource for people that want to dive in and see how comprehensive things could do. So Dane, Steelers Depot, those are the mainstream ones that I would recommend.
And it's like you're reading in my mind, because I was already thinking about taking it a step farther beyond the names of some mainstream sources and thinking of the notion that most sources are closer to some teams than others. In keeping with the two of the three guys I mentioned off the top, Jeremiah served as a scout for Baltimore, Cleveland, and Philadelphia. Yeah. He's currently also the color commentator for the Chargers radio team. And I feel like his connections to Baltimore and the Chargers could be magnified in this betting cycle, since brothers John and Jim Harbaugh are the head coaches of those two respective teams. And then, of course, Chargers general manager, Joe Ortiz, comes from Baltimore. When it comes to a guy like Schrager, my understanding is that he's especially close with the Rams and the Cardinals. So that could possibly lead to nuggets from him that you won't get from anybody else pertaining to those two teams. Any other sources we haven't covered yet, Ron, when it comes to not just good information in general, but maybe sources worth trusting, particularly when it comes to specific teams?
I like what you said about Peter Schrager. I get consistently the least amount of data that I can get, the least amount of intel from the Rams. So maybe I need to pay attention to him a little more, because I can't get anything out of them as far as what they're thinking second, third, fourth round. Not too much else. I think Sports Spider, S-P-Y-D-E-R, you can get all the stories from sportsspider.com that's going on locally, and you can kind of hit on what's going on, and you can get sound bites sometimes from their GM. It used to be with Pete Carroll, you had to read the tea leaves because he would tell you who he liked, but you had to decipher hieroglyphics to do it. And it was so hard because he made it a game. Here's whom we might bet, here's who we didn't get, and stuff like that. And there's a lot of lying going on right now. So you have to be really, really careful. When you start to see some odds move, like we started to see with Jalen Daniels at number 2, then you start to get a picture. But that could backfire too. Will Levis, at this time a year ago, was considered the second pick in the draft and not Stroud. And even 24 hours beforehand, we had some crazy action going on some of these quarterbacks. So you don't want to trust everything you hear, and that's why I like to balance it by my own work.
One quick note, you mentioned the Rams being a tough team to decipher. I heard you talk about trying to figure out what the Rams will do after the first round, so I can't help you there. But I will say, with Schrager's first mock draft that he dropped at the beginning of this week, I think the most conviction he had was in stating that the Rams are going to go offense. And that's not bettable everywhere based on the phrasing of certain props, but there is maybe a way or two to take advantage. So something to consider given Schrager's close ties to Sean McVay and the Rams. Ron, we'll get into the draft plenty more. We will talk about that number 2 overall pick market a bit. But before we go much farther, I also want to acknowledge the prelude to the draft being free agency. When I had you on last year, I didn't touch on free agency, and I feel like that was probably a miss on my end, so I'd like to get it right this time. I'm guessing that free agency has some sort of effect on your approach to betting the draft. If that's correct, I'd love to hear just a little bit about that.
Yeah, I have a few examples of how I would use free agency. Of course, first I'm looking at the roster and all the stats. And, you know, if a team allowed 84 sacks or something like that, like the New York Giants, obviously offensive line is going to be a need. And you can go on in that kind of vein. So the examples I have is Baltimore lost three offensive linemen. That's a cluster loss. That means obviously, they're going to pinpoint offensive line somewhere in the first or second round, and they may do a subtle trade up or a subtle trade down. I can talk about that later. There are certain tendencies that teams have. The Diggs trade, we know what that means for Buffalo. They're probably going to be in the market for a wide receiver. Everybody assumes they're going to trade up for one in the first round. I don't think we automatically assume that, but we do assume that they're going to go after wide receiver. Skewed spending for a team. This is one I haven't heard mentioned, but if you see a team spend a lot of money on one side of the ball, that means the other side of the ball is probably going to get attention during the draft. And it could be intentional because they see the draft as stronger in certain positions and weaker in others, and they're balancing their own portfolio. But that's something I look at. Here's a new one. How about a little fact that Indianapolis, if you follow the Colts, one of the guys would love this comment that I've seen on shows before, Russell, because he likes to talk about the Colts. But they've been so busy signing their own free agents that nobody's paying attention to them. But I am, because if they're going to re-up a lot of money for 6, 7, 8, 9 free agents, I want to know what positions they're re-upping, because those are positions they're probably done with and they're going to look in other directions. So even when a team's not active signing other free agents, it's still important to me. And then the last examples would be Houston and Washington, both remaking their rosters and both in different ways. Washington to completely change the culture, and Houston because they've decided that they got so close and they won the division. All of a sudden, they're almost in an all-in mode when 2 years ago, they were in a Lovie Smith mode of, what are we doing? We're spinning our wheels. So it's very interesting to see how teams evolve and move. And so that tells me that a team like Houston's not going to be afraid. Even though they traded back in the draft, I expect them to trade back up in this draft one or two or three times. And for Washington, I just think they're going to be looking for a different kind of player than they have in the past.
A lot of good food for thought. There are two things I'll follow up on. One would be, I really appreciated the notion of free agency not necessarily equating to players changing teams, but also being aware of what teams are doing with their own free agents. That might say even more about how highly they value a player and what they might want to do moving forward or not do moving forward with regard to that player's position. And second, Ron, you said we might get to it later. I'm not sure if we will. So if there's anything noteworthy with regard to your talk about a subtle trade up or a subtle trade back, I think you were using this in the context of Baltimore in the pursuit of an offensive lineman, since they've seen an exodus at that position in recent months. Can you elaborate on the notion of a subtle trade up or a subtle trade back, considering usually at this time there's almost nothing subtle about trades and trade speculation regarding the NFL draft?
Most teams, most GMs will have a list of three or four players they're targeting at a certain spot. With Baltimore, it's been, I don't want to say easy, but it's been nice to know that they follow a certain form. Under Ozzie Newsome previously, and then the person who took over for him, they're going to do this game that they play where they're willing to move back, but not too far. They're willing to go back from 26 to 29, or they're willing to move up from 26 to 23. So they play within a framework depending on supply and demand at the position, or if they have five players in mind and all five are still available, they're going to move back a little bit. If they have five players in mind and three are off the board, they're going to move up a little bit because they see a gap, either because it's a position of need or these two players that are left, they're so important, we don't want to miss out on either one of them. So that's kind of what I mean, playing that particular game. And with Baltimore, I feel like that's pretty much been their MO.
All right. Appreciate the clarification there. I think we're laying a really strong foundation for how to best approach the draft from a betting perspective. Ron, I'd like to dig in now to one key draft betting principle, as I've come to view it over the years. the thought process of when to be subjective versus when to be more objective, more often than not aiming for the latter. And when it comes to speaking with somebody like you, I know you do about as much research as anybody. So how would you describe your approach to doing your homework and balancing that with the potential risk of focusing too much perhaps on opinions that you form around what teams should do compared to maybe more objective thoughts on what history tells us they will do?
Yeah, so there's enormous conflict here. Even for somebody like me, if I've graded a player, like I graded Will Levis as a second rounder, and then I have to mess with what's going on with him and saying that, well, I wouldn't pick him number two, but what if he's really going to be number two? Luckily, I didn't fall into that trap, but I can fall into that trap. Everybody, naturally, there's so much quarterback talk that you fall into those particular traps. And so I think before I talk about 2024, I should talk about 2023. And the biggest issue is it's a win now league. It's no longer that you get 2 or 3 years to prove yourself and a coach can last. There's a lot of coaches that have been dumped after 1 and 2 years now. And, you know, even the talk of Nick Sirianni, 1 minute he's in the Super Bowl and the next minute they win 11 games and they have to decide whether or not to keep him. It's a very strange situation with social media and everything else that's going on. So even though there's some tried and true tendencies, a lot of the early picks in last year's draft and in this year's draft are going to be made by GMs that we don't have a book on or coaches that we don't have a book on. And that's where the tension comes for me. Do I really trust Tennessee at number 7 to draft Joe Alt, even though there's no other player they should consider except for Joe Alt? That's kind of the tug of war I have to go. Last year, Arizona, with an all-new coaching staff and an all-new draft team, they traded up and back and around and through. You know, they moved from 3 to 6, then they moved back. They did a lot of things. They did it so that they could get 11 picks and 6 of the top 90 in this year's draft. Now everybody automatically says, well, they're going to trade out of 4. And then they're going to come back because they did it last year. And I would say not so fast, because if you have 6 of the top 90 picks, why do you really need to move around? So those are some of the things I'm looking at. We saw the Lions get caught last year with Weatherspoon going at 5 and they didn't have a plan B. And so they started overdrafting their players. Luckily, they were all good players and they all fit, but their whole draft board changes. And if you're betting the draft, like I am and like other people and so on, you have to realize that 1 or 2 bad moves by a GM or moves that you didn't anticipate because they're new can screw up the next 10 picks in the draft. So it just makes everything crazy. So for this year, what's New England going to do at 3 with a new regime? It's not going to be a one-person dictatorial reign anymore. There's going to be Elliot Wolf who's going to take some consensus. It's not Bill Belichick pulling the trigger. You know the Chargers better than most people. They haven't used a phone in the last decade. Nobody needs to call them. They haven't traded. 43 trades last year. Their phone was in another room somewhere because 6 of the last 8 years they haven't traded. Well, this year, maybe they end up with 12 picks because the culture, the whole way that Jim Harbaugh is going to build this roster is going to be completely different. I really think he's going to concentrate on O-line and D-line, the trenches. Daniel Jones is with the New York Giants. What do we do with him? 1 year, and then they could dump him after 1 year, but do they get their quarterback now? Do they wait? Do they build the rest of the roster up? Are they going to trade up again? Because some teams, they just can't help themselves. They trade up. They don't know how to trade down. So these are the things that tear at me to determine, can I understand what a new GM or new coach is going to do?
And in that answer, Ron, you hit on some of the most interesting dynamics of this draft. We will circle back over the course of this conversation and close some of those loose threads. But for now, to start to harness all of that information and the should we or shouldn't we bet in a certain manner, I also want to note that this week, if I am understanding correctly, you will be releasing a ranked order list of prospects at each position. I'm wondering, again, to the notion of doing your homework and having a good reason to have formed strong opinions, how you think releasing this ranked order list would be valuable for people catching this conversation to look to build that into their larger draft betting game plans themselves.
I'm not going to be actually releasing the list because it's written. I could probably cut and paste in Excel and do that because I've moved people up and down and stuff. And it is a pre-draft list. I'm more than willing to answer any questions about any particular player, you know, whether it be the 15th best cornerback or the 8th best wide receiver, but it's probably too much to release all that. And I strongly, this may come up later, in person team fit. So my pre-ranking, and when we talk about quarterbacks, I can explain that. My pre-ranking is going to be different than my after-draft ranking. But I wanted to know the strengths of this draft class. And the most important thing about a pre-ranking is not what Ron thinks is the 8th best or the 9th best or the 10th best, but where the gaps are. Is there a gap between Brock Bowers and the second tight end? It's a huge gap. Is there a gap between running back 1 and running back 4? No. Is there a gap? Where's the gap at cornerback? I think it comes after the 4th or 5th cornerback. Where's the gap at each position? That's the most important thing.
Got it. And I think that can tie directly back to what you mentioned off the top about books like Circa posting over-unders that go well beyond the first round. And that's where there's a lot of opportunity to be had for those who happen to be in the right jurisdictions and for those who can be quick on the trigger. And Ron, to your point about pre-draft versus post-draft thoughts, one more thing I want to hit on before we get to some specific players and teams that could be pivot points in the first round. Once we get past the draft, I think it's still important not to stray too far from objectivity. There's going to be instant analysis with team and pick grades virtually everywhere. In my book, that's almost entirely going to be white noise. So I'd advise anybody listening to proceed with caution when it comes to betting on things like rookie of the year based on landing spot, or team futures based on what we think in the immediate aftermath of a team's draft. My admittedly very cold take here is that I found the prudent path to be giving it 2 or 3 years of NFL experience before forming an opinion on a given draft class. So if anything, in the aftermath of this year's draft, I'll be monitoring the betting markets closely for possible overreactions and be inclined to look the other way, if anything. On your end, Ron, what do you make of knee-jerk reactions that we see almost like clockwork when it comes to the draft and any possible betting opportunities that you have an eye out for that might become available?
Yeah, well, again, this is one piece of the puzzle. If people have done their homework already, they formed an opinion based on what the stats showed last year and where there are obvious holes and obvious strengths, what they did in free agency to address those holes, and make, you know, and so that we have a clear need of what their need board is. After the draft, my knee-jerk reaction is, did they fill these needs? And if they did, that checks another piece of the puzzle. If they didn't, fantastic. I could look to fade them. If they drafted the right positions but not the right players, like the Bears a couple of years ago, took 4 offensive linemen, 3 of them of the 4, I didn't even have as draft eligible. Draft, you know, they didn't make my top 220 or top 230. I typically have about 230-ish players who I think are worthy of being drafted. Well, 3 of their 4 offensive line picks weren't worthy of being drafted. Look at Jacksonville last year. They had 12 draft picks because they made 7 turn into 12. And a world record in my book, 7 of them were not draft worthy. I've never had close to that. But I have a thing with Jacksonville's GM, and I'm not going to be invited to dinner with him because we've had this thing for years and years about how he screws them over. But it led to me thinking, well, they didn't solve anything. I know the public sees 12 picks. They didn't solve anything. I'm going to fade them. And then the final piece is actually the schedule. It's not who you play. We know who they play, but when you play them. What's that minus 20 rest differential? What's that new coach that doesn't get that bye week to reassess until week 7, 8, 9? So the draft is one piece of 4 for me.
Got it. And I was going to bet, Ron, before we had this conversation, if there was one team that would not be inviting you to dinner, I would have guessed the Atlanta Falcons, because we like to call it that they refuse to draft defensive ends. So I guess Jacksonville, not too far away. Maybe it's a regional thing, but understood on the Jags as well. And as you speak about a specific team, let's go ahead and dive into, well, we'll get to one team in a bit, but three specific players I'd like to start with first. And leading off, let's talk Marvin Harrison Jr. Last week in an article that you wrote breaking down predictions for the top 10 picks, you seem to have pretty strong conviction that Arizona picks him at 4. This wouldn't surprise anybody, but the level of conviction might be actionable, so I'd like to dive into it a bit here. Ron, you touched on the fact that last year Arizona traded back, but they probably don't need to this time around with those 11 picks, including 6 in the top 90. So I hear you on the logical outcome being that Arizona sticks with a pick and doesn't overthink it. They take Harrison. You suggested considering draft props with this in mind. And as I consider potential ways to put this into practice, I'll throw a few numbers your way. And over the rest of this discussion, for reference to the audience, these odds, I know the draft can be a very fluid market. As of just before 8 p.m. Eastern on Wednesday, April 17th, these are the current numbers that I'll be citing. So Harrison to go, number 4 overall, minus 190 at DraftKings, minus 220 at FanDuel, minus 235 at BetOnline. If we look at Harrison to go top 5, a lot more vig, but also a very attractive number to get 5 if that's where he goes. Minus 1,500 at FanDuel and BetOnline, minus 1,600 at DraftKings. Circa also has Harrison over under 4.5, so consider him minus 350 to go top 4 at Circa. And one more market, Ron, first receiver selected, minus 500 for Harrison at DraftKings, minus 600 at FanDuel and BetOnline. So with all these possibilities in mind, I'm wondering if you can elaborate on perhaps how to best bet on your conviction that Arizona sticks at 4 and takes Harrison.
Yeah, it's tricky. It's not like I know the draft team, you know, but more than 1 year of experience, but I would run that card up if I was at 4 and Harrison. There is, again, no need for them to trade back. I think with all those minus 500, minus 1600, it's too risky. There are some teams I know that have neighbors higher than Harrison. And get used to this, Matt. Unfortunately, we're going to have, you know, a little bit less data than we've ever had. Harrison refused to run, refused to work out and run for the teams. They didn't even measure his height at one of the points in the process. I think you're going to see people completely skip the combine. I think people are just going to go there for medical thing. And there's just a lot of different noise about how the players aren't going to go through this grueling 4-day stretch anymore. And Harrison might be just the tip of the iceberg that we don't have all the information. But I still think this is the guy the Cardinals have number one on their list. This is the guy that they know is going to be there unless New England pulls something out of a hat and picks Harrison or somebody trades above them. So I think the 190, again, I like to put it always in return on investment. I would think the odds are, personally, for me, 3 out of 4 that he is picked there by Arizona at number 4. So that means you're risking 194 times and you're going to be right 3 times. So there's still a positive return on investment, whatever it is, 14% or something like that, that Harrison goes at 4 to Arizona.
And to put it in other terms as well, if this is helpful for anybody listening, you said a 3 out of 4 chance that would equate to minus 300, which equates to 75%. So if we're thinking probabilistically in terms of percentages, the minus 190 number at DraftKings breaks out to a 65.5% break-even probability. So there's a nice delta there of about 9.5 percentage points. That's quite meaningful. So it sounds like, Ron, that would be your choice of all the numbers I ran down. Harrison to go number 4, minus 190 at DraftKings. I hear you on there still being some uncertainty, so not wanting to lay too much vig. So I get it that that's your preference of all the numbers I mentioned. Would you say that's actionable, or that's just a preference that you have based on the numbers out there, but maybe proceed with caution when it comes to actually putting money on the line when it comes to Harrison, number 4 overall?
Yeah, and first of all, the way you laid it out, even more than my return on investment, the 75% versus 65%, some and so on, I think that's what everybody should do. Just don't automatically assume that you have an edge until you calculate that edge. Use all those math classes that you took in high school and college and put them, you know, because you need to know that you have that particular edge. I think it's actionable at 190. I wouldn't go much above that. And I don't think it's absolutely the lock of the year. Of course, you'll never hear that from me anyway. But I think it's worth a little bit.
All right. I hear you on that. And because I love to do this when I have you on the show, playing just a bit of devil's advocate, but in a well-intentioned, hopefully thoughtful manner. We talked about Schrager earlier, and he's got close ties to Arizona. And in his mock this week, he had Arizona trading with the Giants and taking Rome Odunze at 6 ahead of Malik Nabers. More on Odunze in just a moment. But Ron, based on the source, any hesitation when you hear that from a guy like Schrager, considering how strongly you feel about linking Harrison to Arizona at 4?
Yeah, I haven't charted Schrager as I have occasionally some of the other guys who talk and carry big audiences. And if it was one of those other guys who talk and carry big audiences and they said that, I'd probably put more money on it, because I think they're dealt sometimes false information. And you've heard them kind of cover their bases by saying, well, they're using words that give them an out if it doesn't happen. It's a small play. It's just based on how I perceive what Arizona should do. And they're in a much different situation with so many picks in the first three rounds. My argument would be, why? Why would you move out? And maybe they would have an automatic handshake deal in place with the Chargers or so on, or another team. But I wouldn't personally take the chance. I would just take 6 players at 6 positions. And at the end of the day, if the Cardinals did as well as they did in last year's draft, this is a far better team and a team that could contend faster rather than what we might have suspected a few months ago.
All right, well, let's move on from Marvin Harrison and the potentially strong ties to Arizona to another receiver near the top of this year's class, Rome Odunze. Ron, in the same article I touched on a few moments ago that you published last week, I believe you put that you had a 35% shot on Odunze being available at pick 11. And when I looked at pricing on Odunze to go top 10, I'm seeing minus 1350 at FanDuel, minus 1500 at BetOnline, minus 1600 at DraftKings. And for whatever it's worth, Circa's over under on Odunze 8.5, under juiced fairly heavily at minus 160. So conservatively for Odunze to go top 10, let's take that FanDuel number is the lowest one on the board, minus 1350. That implied probability is greater than a 93% chance that Odunze goes in the top 10. And if we want to account for the VIG, because this is a one-way market that buries a lot of VIG to try to attract bettors maybe more than certain books should, let's just say in reality, it's maybe not greater than 93%. It's about 90% likely, we could assume based on this number, that Odunze goes top 10, and therefore about 10% likely that he's still on the board at 11. Admittedly, the NFL draft is not the most efficient market, so we don't have to take currently available betting numbers as gospel. But still, Ron, your 35% prediction is significantly different than that market projection of about a 10% probability that Odunze makes it to pick 11. So first off, I'd love to peel back the curtain a bit and learn more about what's behind your methodology for pegging it at 35% that Odunze slips out of the top 10.
It would be quarterback driven, like everything. I don't believe quarterbacks will go 1, 2, 3, 4. That's the first of all. I don't know if the Giants are going to draft a quarterback at 6. Denver doesn't seem to have the ammunition to go up. So I think they're in the market for other quarterbacks, Nixon, Penix, which are generally not top 10 quarterbacks. So that doesn't leave a lot of teams. It leaves just Minnesota. So in that scenario, when I wrote the article, I thought Minnesota could trade from 11 to 9. Minnesota has a storied history of trading within the division with this new GM. So that's not news. They go to 11 to 9 to get somebody ahead of the Jets at 10, or, you know, just to make a move in that particular vein. That would leave Odunze available after that. But theoretically, Odunze would be gone at pick 9. I did take some plus money, not as much as it is now. I like Odunze. First of all, let me preface it by saying that I think he's a legit first-round talent. He's the type of receiver that's probably not going to give people trouble. And there are certain receivers that wear out their welcome and stuff like that. He's a hard worker, but he reminds me, I'm trying to think of the name of the person. It escapes me right now. Maybe a little bit of Crabtree, Michael Crabtree, and some of those where he's going to snatch every ball. He's going to do all these things. When he gets the ball in his hands, he can't. He has these long strides, but he's not going to be a neighbor's electric guy. He's not going to be one of these guys who runs that 4.4 kind of speed. And I kind of think those guys don't really go in the first 6, 7, 8 picks. He's better than the 4 that went last year, but those guys started at pick 20. So part of me feels that he is a number 9 to number 15 kind of pick in wide receiver. And that when the dust settles and when the offensive linemen start coming off the board, and if there are 4 corner quarterbacks that come off the board, and what happens to Brock Bowers and so on, what does Atlanta do, that we're running out of places for Odunze. So I took a little bit of over 8.5.
All right. One more player I want to get into specifically with you, JJ McCarthy. I know you and our friend Dan have some thoughts on him, and you chronicled that pretty well in a YouTube video that is live on your YouTube channel. So to start this off, on one hand, I think you'd be quick to call out that McCarthy only had 8 pass attempts in his team's biggest game of the season to date against Penn State. And so it's very fair to ask, if his college team didn't lean on him in a big game, why would an NFL team aggressively pursue him? And on the other hand, you could say, looking at that matchup, the Michigan offensive line couldn't block Chop Robinson. And frankly, they didn't need to. Jim Harbaugh could lean on his identity, that ground and pound attack. And Michigan did impose its will in the run game, and they won this game going away. Also, to parallel how we often discuss teams, you can only play the opponents on your schedule. To tie that in with McCarthy, you can only really do what's asked of you. And when he needed to make big plays in crucial moments of even bigger games, he rose to the occasion, thinking of crunch time against Alabama in the Rose Bowl. So all that said, Ron, current betting odds when it comes to McCarthy to be a top 5 pick, minus 150 at Circa, minus 165 at DraftKings, minus 175 at FanDuel and BetOnline. All that said, I'd love to pause for a moment and get your point of view on McCarthy's draft prospects.
Okay, so the Penn State tape was worrisome in terms of the 8, you know, didn't throw a pass after the second quarter. But some people say he was hiding an injury or the team was hiding an injury. I understand the Penn State deal. The Michigan sent 18 players to the combine. That tells me that their offensive line, maybe they couldn't block Chop Robinson that particular day, but it was still, I believe they won the Joe Moore Award for best offensive line in the nation. They have these receivers that can go up and get balls. They have Blake Corum. Obviously, philosophically, Jim Harbaugh, if he sees a weakness and that you can run, then they're going to run the whole time. So I understand that. But when I'm not paid as a draft analyst or anything. I do this as a labor of love, but I obviously did want to go back and look at his tape because he's a quarterback. I want to know what my real true feelings of him. And I saw him float some balls and I saw him sail some passes. So my evaluation of McCarthy is a second round grade unless he goes to Minnesota, because as you probably know, young quarterbacks need a really good tight end and a stout offensive line. Otherwise, they're going to waste away like so many of the recent quarterbacks have wasted away. Zach Wilson and others have wasted away as top 10 picks. Josh Rosen, Sam Darnold, they all went to teams without either a tight end and or an offensive line. Well, Minnesota's good in that area. I will give McCarthy a first round grade if he goes to Minnesota. But I'd rather see Minnesota not even use pick 11 for him, but I could understand it if they move from, let's say they moved to 11 to 9 and they took him. He still gets a first round grade for me, but I can't believe somebody would, on limited tape and what I saw in his throws, would draft him in the top 5 or 6 picks. So I'm just going to go based on that. Smart guy, avoid sacks. So he's different than Daniel Jones. Daniel Jones came in with an internal clock issue. I documented that, you know, so many times, and that hasn't changed. McCarthy's a similar player, but without an internal clock issue. So he's better than Daniel Jones.
And to your point about smart guy, what I've heard is that if NFL teams get him in a meeting room and in front of a whiteboard, that's where he can really shine. So I know this can be as much of an art as it is a science, probably more of an art than a science, given even NFL teams' deep-pocketed resources still not cracking the code in terms of how to best evaluate quarterbacks. So, Ron, I hear you that you've got a second-round grade on him unless he goes to one specific team. With that said, given a lot of the money and the odds shaded heavily toward McCarthy going in the top five, do you have any bets involving McCarthy?
Yeah, I had an early bet over 4.5, and I also have the over 5.5. Can't help myself. If somebody drafts them, I'll skewer them in my draft post-analysis. But if you talk to any of the analysts during the season, even in November and December, who had McCarthy anywhere close to a top 50 pick at that time? Immediate, you know, these big rises, eventually they start settling. And then we'll see what happens. He beefed up for the combine so that he could put more oomph in his throw, put more power in his throw. But in the course of a wear and tear of a season, I think he has to put more of his body into the throws that he makes as opposed to some of the other quarterbacks.
All right. Well, one team that is not going to be in the market for a quarterback based on what they've done in recent weeks and months, probably going to be the Pittsburgh Steelers. You touched on Steelers Depot earlier as a good information source. And Pittsburgh does seem to have a history of being more transparent than teams like, I think, the Rams that you mentioned, where it's really reading the tea leaves. Pittsburgh, no stranger to tipping its hand a little bit. And as of last week, it sounded like you were hearing they were eyeing two offensive linemen in the past week, Ron. Any updates as of now on where you see the Steelers going with their first pick?
No, I still think it'll be offensive line, though you will typically go wide receiver later. They did surprise a lot of people last year. I had them going offensive line last year, but I did not have them jumping the Jets to get that fourth of the four best offensive linemen, and they caught the Jets flat-footed that year. So they're not afraid to move up. So if they really like the fourth best wide receiver, they may go up and get that fourth best wide receiver. But right now, I'd stick O-line.
All right, and looking at the odds to possibly put your money where your mouth is, and maybe you got down early, so you don't need to worry so much about these current odds, but to those of us who haven't invested yet, Pittsburgh, position of their first draft pick, offensive line, minus 320 at FanDuel, minus 330 at DraftKings. If we use that minus 320 number, the break-even percentage comes out to 76.2%. And for what it's worth, Schrager's mock this week had Pittsburgh going wide receiver. So, Ron, I also noticed that Circa had the Steelers price at minus 335 to go offense. Compared to those offensive line prices, we're getting, you know, a little more big, but virtually a free roll in case they take a wide receiver instead. How confident are you that Pittsburgh takes an offensive lineman? And how would you compare the minus 320 for O-line to minus 335 for offense?
Wouldn't touch it. Wouldn't touch it at all. In fact, if I were in the Steelers draft room, I might draft the, believe this or not, the TJ Watt, the Watt replacement, because I believe, like Aaron Donald, that Watt goes one or two more years and then retires. I just think that there's probably some internal talk in the building, and it may not happen till next year. But at some point, I wouldn't rule out them taking best available player at 18, if somebody, or at 20, wherever they are. If there's a player that slides down in the draft that meets their needs. So I would be very uncomfortable, even though I think it's going to be offensive linemen. It's way too rich for what I would do.
And that gets into the next topic I'd like to explore with you, not just what we think should happen or even what we think will happen with some good information, but knowing that it all does come down to the price. There's a topic that I often kick around, sometimes in my own head, sometimes on this show, as a sanity check. I think of it as the tension between getting the best of the number and being willing to take a bettable number. And thinking of the draft with regard to this notion, I have a sense that some pretty sharp bettors would be willing to pass on the best of the number and ultimately take a worse number as long as that trade-off in price was worth the additional information and confidence, tying back to this being an information-driven market of all information-driven markets. So, Ron, for the purposes of this exercise, let's try to forget about personal opinions. Again, the notion of putting what we think teams will do over what we think they should do. And I want to use that to talk a bit about the number two overall pick and Drake May in particular. His current odds to go number two overall, plus 200 at BetOnline, plus 220 at FanDuel, all the way up to plus 260 at DraftKings. Conservatively, with that plus 200 number at BetOnline being best available, let's call it that, it translates to a 33.3% break-even probability that May goes two overall. And I would be willing to bet that some sharps would pass on that number today, even if they priced it as 40% likely that May goes number two. And that delta between 33.3% break-even and 40% true probability, that would imply meaningful positive expected value. But the reason a lot of bettors might pass is that they'd rather get more information and potentially even lay minus 200, a 66.7% break-even probability, if they get the intel that it's much more likely than that to occur at the end of the day. So to sum it up, I know there's this delicate balance between not just what to bet, but also when and how to bet it. Ron, how would you describe your thoughts on that tension between getting the best of the number versus perhaps taking a worse number, so long as you still consider it to be bettable based on the latest information?
Yeah, for drafts, I think it's different than if you're betting games during the season. At some point, if you miss the best number, if you miss a number that's more likely to land on, you have to let it slide and you go to another game. But draft information travels quickly. You can miss a number. And then us being in California, you may not even have access to that number in your. And so for me, if I see a minus 120 on somebody and I just don't have action, you know, I can't get to it. And then when it comes available for me in an offshore place at minus 140, I just have to treat it as if, well, that's the best number that I could get. Is it still a return on investment for me? And I'm willing to do those kinds of things. Now, the Daniels May thing is very interesting because I don't know if it was a week or longer than a week ago. There was some talk and there was some very good talk about, you know, some people that I respect. I think it was Connor Allen and a couple of others who saw some information saying that Daniels is going at two. And I basically said that 3 weeks out from the draft, that's not true. Most teams haven't even laid out their board 3 weeks out from the draft. There's still the private 30 visits. There's so much else going on. It may lean that way, but even though the price at that time might have been, I think Daniels at one time was plus money. You know, Daniels and May were back and forth. And then it became minus and so on. About 2 days, 3 days, 4 days ago, I was ready to say, okay, I've done enough work. I've connected some dots. I've looked at Kingsbury's types of offenses as the offensive coordinator. We know they're going quarterback. I think it is Daniels. I think it was already up to 160, 165 at that point. I think it's worthy of a play there. I think Daniels might be the person. And I've been burned every once in a while on some of this stuff. So I went pretty small. But I kind of got the feeling, so I passed on a much better number earlier because I didn't believe, I hadn't done my own work, and I didn't believe that that decision had even come close to being made at that point.
I appreciate the context as I laid things out for Drake May that you were able to share on the Jaden Daniels side of the equation. And I guess in the spirit of that two-way dynamic with such a volatile market, I'd love to share one tip for those willing to go maybe just a bit deeper when it comes to the math, and then we'll get to some more fun stuff in short order here. But one tip that I would like to share here that has served me well over the years is, instead of line shopping for arbitrage opportunities where we can guarantee a small profit, unlocking bigger plus EV opportunities by simply looking to spot the sucker and just bet the bad line. So an example here would be taking a sharp book against a square book. Let's say, generally speaking, a bookmaker or Circa against a DraftKings or FanDuel. And again, math alert here, but looking to identify the no vig price at the sharper books. Let's say a prop like under X number of players at Y position in the first round, minus 240 at a sharp book. To calculate the no vig price, we can simply take the midpoint between the plus money and minus numbers being offered Stafford. So say something is minus 240, take back plus 185. The Novig line would be the sum of 240 plus 185 divided by 2. So 425 divided by 2, Novig number being minus 212 and a half one way, plus 212 and a half the other way. That number becomes the source of truth in this equation, courtesy of the sharp book. Now with the square book, sometimes they could have the same prop under the same number of players at the same position, but a different price. And at times it could skew far away from our source of truth. I've seen a case where maybe minus 212 and a half is the Novik line at a sharp book and minus 190 is the lay price at a square book. So here we have an opportunity to beat the Novig line at the sharp book by a meaningful margin. This example has minus 190 compared to minus 212 and a half. We're talking a break-even probability delta of 65.5% versus 68%. 2.5 percentage points might sound like small potatoes, but in the long run, it's not. I think we can just leave the sharp book alone and just lay that quote-unquote bad number minus 190 at the square book. And two words of caution, Ron, then I want to get your thoughts on this. I know when we're talking about the draft, it's a fluid market. So when in doubt, I would encourage people even looking to adopt this process to wait around, get as much information as possible before betting. And second, books that are sources of truth in some markets aren't necessarily sources of truth in all markets. So this does require some due diligence. But with that said, using this process, I think it over time works out quite well. And I think edges are currently available across several markets adopting this approach. So in one way, to me, this is kind of the anti-Ron approach based on my understanding of how you do it, because this is purely top down. But that said, I know there's often more than one path to profitability. And Ron, with all that said, I would be curious to get your thoughts on an angle like this.
Yeah, I think if you're leaning in a direction, then you look at this kind of thing. And if there's an outlier, why is that one an outlier? And if you don't trust that, then you go that way. If you had no opinion on it beforehand, I probably wouldn't do it unless there was a bigger edge, or you could do an arb or a middle if that comes in. So I understand that approach, but you don't always know what the sharp books are for draft. It's really more slow moving than sharp, because Circa has admittedly, especially when Chris and I had Matt Metcalf on a couple years ago and stuff like that, they didn't want to get into the prop market because their forte was being so sharp in the regular markets. But they did it because people wanted to have it, and it's a common thing now. People are getting into it. So Circa's opening numbers, they took some hits on it for a reason, because I mean, I wish I was there in front of the line for some of them, because there were some really hits. But after the market matures, that's when you can use your approach, I think, and say there's an outlier, but they're an outlier because why? And if it's because they don't know what they're doing or they didn't move with the market, I think there's some value.
Yeah, I appreciate that thought, because to the caveat of the market being fluid, when in doubt, wait and get as much information as possible. Circa has a certain reputation, but when they hang draft props, another good rule of thumb, look at the limits. I mean, if they're opening NFL sides, again, being in California, I'm not as familiar with their openers. I would be surprised if Circa didn't open taking, what, $10,000 or $20,000 on NFL sides during the regular season and go up from there over the course of a week. In the draft betting market right now, they're taking $500. So the limits are often a good indication of how much confidence a book has in its number.
Absolutely.
Alas, a lot of books aren't like Circa and they're not as transparent with their limits. So it can be a bit of a cat and mouse game. But I think that once we take a time like this where a quote unquote sharp book has been open for more than 2 days in this market, to your point, the numbers have been beaten up quite a bit. At this stage, Circa does take on sharp clientele. They're not going to limit you if you make a bunch of $500 limit bets and get a really good number. They'll use that to shape their line and deliver a better product from their side of the counter. So at a stage like this, it's not a virgin number anymore, but if there is still a significant delta between the Novig price at a book like Circa, this is the kind of time when that might mean some sort of signal relative to possibly seeing outlier prices at more recreational books. Does that logic check out?
Agree completely. They change stripes, whereas you can exploit them early. You want to build on what they're developing and go elsewhere late.
All right. Well, that was quite the windup from me, but I think we have safely landed the plane. So thank you for helping us to get there. I want to talk a few more quick draft topics here, Ron. One, thinking as a nod to one of the best movies from 2023. Let's call this little segment The Anatomy of a Windfall, putting some positive energy out there for a profitable draft. And thinking of different bet types, such as over-unders for player draft slots, number of players taken at a specific position in the first round, or number of players taken from a certain college conference in the first round. Other bet types including matchups, player X versus player Y who goes first, position of a team's first pick, players to go in the top five or in the top 10 or in the first round, or players to be taken at X pick, kind of like what we talked about with Harrison, pegging the exact draft slot. Overall, how do you think your final portfolio will break down if we envision a pie chart in terms of how you'd invest in all these different markets?
Okay, now this has changed over the years for a variety of reasons. Number one, markets move so fast and you don't get the really good number on first quarterback, first running back, first this, that, whatever. You have to have some quick opinions. So I don't have as many of that. My portfolio is not 50-50, but let's say 40-40 on players position over 26 and a half, over 73 and a half, that kind of thing. And then the new market that I've been getting into is what is the position of the team's first draft choice? Because what we've found in the last 2 years alone is that 5 to 10 of the outcomes are going to be plus 300 and higher. So if you have, if you don't really know where team number drafting 25th is going to go, and they don't know how the draft is going to shake out, but you think they have three or four equally distributed needs, you might get a plus 600 on defensive lineman going with the first pick or cornerback going with the first pick. I think I hit a plus 1,000 and a plus 1,500 last year. And the other good thing about this market is that this is the one area where books haven't really cloned each other as much. You can find a vast difference between DraftKings and FanDuel, for example. One position might be plus 800 and the other might be plus 390 or plus 1200 or something like that. So you could actually get differences and you don't have to put a lot of money on it to win at plus. You could do this recreationally and all of a sudden you're, you know, your portfolio is growing and you don't have to hit a lot of them. I think I put out an article last year. I recommended a whole bunch of them and I think 25% of them hit. But how many do you need to hit if you have a plus 1,000 or a plus, you know, 800 on? So it's a good market to get into, especially if you're dealing like me where I have a couple of books I can't play anymore because I'm allowed 50 cents. So that's it.
But they didn't ban you. To their credit, they did not ban you technically.
No, but if their minimum is $5 and they let me bet 50 cents, I put it in just to see what would happen. And they said, sorry, this is below the limit. Well,
yeah, it's the good old ban without technically being banned. So they can say they don't ban players. So very tongue in cheek from me. But Ron, along those lines, if we want to think of good markets to consider getting into, as I ask this, keep in mind, I'm much more interested in the process than past posting, but what would you describe as the best draft bet you have in your portfolio so far and why you think that's the case?
Yeah, I'm trying to think what the best, I know what would have been the best if I were near Circa, but that's a moot point. So we're not going to go there. Here's one that moved at Circa. So it moved. There's a defensive tackle named Newton. I kind of like him. Not everybody likes him, but his number was originally 18 and a half over under, and it went to 28 and a half. And I said, okay, that's a fair number. You know, everybody's betting over or whatever, but I think he's a first rounder. So I looked at some of the sites. Okay, now that everybody's betting over on him, what are his first round odds? And his first round odds weren't that bad. So I said yes, that he would go in the first round, which means 32 or lower. And I had to weigh juice, but it wasn't horrible. And I think he's a first rounder, most likely 80% of the time. And if you could weigh, you know, and I was weighing 200 at the time. So I hate to lay 200. I really hate to lay 200, but you know, that implies a 2 out of 3 as opposed to the 80%. So I kind of like that ticket.
Yeah, I mean, if you're talking 67% break even and you think it's an 80% true probability, then there's a lot of value to be had there. And I like the way that you outlined that. If I were to share one tip on this episode, that's probably much more eloquent than what I did share a few minutes ago, but kind of triangulating information from different sources. And sometimes these sources can be the sports books themselves. So even if we're not in a jurisdiction that gives us access to Circa, to understand, even once all the steam to the over on a certain player has settled in where he's still somewhat comfortably in the first round, well, a lot of books we can access in the offshore market have, will this player be drafted in the first round? So we can kind of use a Circa number as a source of truth to make a different but closely related bet. So I really like the way you laid that out. And Ron, that said, there are two sides to every coin. So the predictable follow-up question, what's the worst draft bet you've made thus far and why?
So I have to go back to what I probably said on the show a year ago. In May of 2022, is that what it is? I actually bet, I had a prop on the 2023 draft. Would there be over under 4.5 quarterbacks going in the first round? And it was minus 250. And I said, oh, give me that all day. And so I bet that the max at minus 250. When we did the show, or when I was on shows last year at this time with the Levis and with everybody else and so on, that prop was plus money. It was the worst, you know, I had the worst closing line value you could actually have, but it won comfortably anyway. So I'll always remember that one. I'm having second thoughts on, and this is a struggle we talked about earlier, I'm having second thoughts on betting Pinnix, the quarterback, under 32.5. It was plus 140. I think at BetUS and others, it's still plus 130. He has a lot of injury concerns, typically like Hooker last year, Henson Hooker, and others. They tend to have a lot of hype, but they never go in the first round. They always go later. But there's just been so much talk about him, and the fit to Minnesota looks, to me, Minnesota should take him in the first round. By trading 20, if they want to pick him at 23 or whatever, I have him again as a second rounder, like McCarthy, unless he goes to Minnesota, and then maybe I would consider him as a first rounder. And he hasn't been hurt the last 2 years, but he did get banged up a little in the Michigan game, so he is a little bit about that. And he had such a strong offensive line at Washington, another Joe Moore contender for best offensive line. Even though I got some plus money on that one, I'm still having second thoughts because those kind of quarterbacks tend not to go in the first round. So I jumped the gun because I got plus money. I don't know how I'll feel about it when it's closer to post time.
That sounds like another case of being torn between what you think teams should do versus what they probably will do. Thinking of Penix, my understanding is that teams put quite a bit of emphasis on a player's age when he's entering the draft, on his injury history for understandable reasons. And I know that Penix throws a beautiful deep ball. I've heard that there's some talk, certain teams prefer not to have a left-handed quarterback because it kind of flips the offense. I don't know how much merit to put into that notion. We've seen some left-handed quarterbacks do just fine over the years. And one more thing when it comes to Penix, I don't have any inside information as far as his processing ability goes, but there might be a case of, based on Michigan's defense seemed to confuse him quite a bit in the championship game. Not necessarily the antithesis, but McCarthy really shining if he gets in a meeting room in front of that whiteboard. I'm not sure if that's as much of what we see with a guy like Penix, but if you see him on the field throwing deep balls, it's so pretty. So I see where it can be very tantalizing, especially if you see a team like Minnesota where, hey, drop him in with the right supporting cast and it could be bombs away. And then we could also be sitting on our hands a good bit into day two and he's still on the board.
He had only two poor games. I mean, the guy was 65, 70%. Of course, he had plenty of talent around him. We're talking about all those Washington draft choices and so on. Michigan confused him. Oregon State destroyed him, 13 of 28. But Oregon State plays a very pro-style offense with its corners man-to-man and press and with an improved pass rush. It's going to take certain types of teams to discourage Penix, but we saw what Michigan did in a championship game. And And still Washington was in the game. He threw so many passes that it got him back in the game. They just had so much talent. But it's a concern with his age and so on that he had 6 years of experience. And at the highest level, it's not going to always go in his favor.
Ron, at this stage, we've covered a lot of ground when it comes to the draft. I've got one more draft question for you, then a few things going beyond the scope of this year's NFL draft. What are you watching for most closely between this conversation right now and the draft beginning next Thursday evening?
I'm almost not going to tune into any draft shows. Pretty much going to go and now scour the local media, get as much information as I can to make sure I've nailed as many of those private workouts and visits as I can. And I have some past history on what teams value them more than others and stuff like that. And it's not just, again, it's more that I want the visits to know what positions, not necessarily the player, but what positions are being targeted. If this team absolutely needs an offensive lineman and they view, and I know 25 of their visits and not one offensive lineman has visited their building, I'm going to do a double take. So I'm going to look at other stuff. So I'm just kind of matching that up. I want to give a shout out to somebody I believe you know, Cleve TA.
And yeah.
Because
yeah, great friend of the show.
He put out this beautiful chart about their, you know, what teams, their first choice, their second option, and so on and so forth. And it's the same kind of thing that I've done, not even in his detail over the past decade, where I've given them a first option and a second and third option and a what I would do option. I haven't put it next to the team needs. But it's the kind of layout that I will be putting together as a final layout in the next few days.
When you talk about the team visits, one question I have for you, I can't remember if this was your article that I read last week or elsewhere that I've seen it, but there's been a lot of betting interest in the Chargers to take an offensive lineman laying some vig. And if I've got my facts in order, thinking about what local reporters are saying, the Chargers' visits have not included any offensive linemen thus far. On one hand, you could say, okay, they're picking five. If they trade back, they've identified their guy, so why would they waste a visit on somebody? On the other hand, you could say, hey, they just got rid of Keenan Allen and Mike Williams. Maybe they are going to go after one of these receivers with their first pick. If you hear a team hasn't spent any of its visits on a certain position group, yet that appears to be a position group of need for the team, what do you do with that information?
Yeah, I have to have a confidence level that I know the GM or don't know the GM and figure it out from there. I relook at their org chart, their depth chart, to see if I'm missing something. I have the free agent stuff, but are they plugged in terms of veteran leadership at each of the positions? So I will reassess my feeling about what that team need is. And in the case of Jim Harbaugh, we have San Francisco data from the past, but the problem is I think he's a little devious to begin with. So I don't know that I'm going to be correct if I try to get into his head and into his mind about what we're going to get there. So I'm going to say I wouldn't be surprised if they don't pick somebody that didn't have personal workout with them. I'm just going to be gathering information, but I don't think I'll be the expert on the Chargers this year. I was hoping you would.
Well, if I'm reading between the lines correctly, I guess my expert take related to the Chargers would be that you are trying to be diplomatic and using the word devious to describe Jim Harbaugh and maybe your thoughts on one of the more polarizing coaches across the landscape. But Ron, as we stick with the NFL here and move beyond the draft, I also know you to be a special team savant, and I'd love to hear from you if you could recap the new kickoff rules we're going to see this coming season and how you think that's going to affect the game, whether that's from an entertainment perspective and or a betting perspective.
People of a certain age remember the game Strat-O-Matic, where you have these mechanical guys that go in circles and they move around. That's the new kickoff rule. You just put them in a line and then they twirl around, and that's what they're doing. But it's a fascinating question that goes in. And I think what the ultimate result is that quick twitch guys that can make one cut and be gone, or Cordell Patterson types who have the vision that they need and the power to break a tackle, because they're all going to be lining up in a row. You're not going to have this where they all can converge on the kickoff. At the beginning, even though they're ahead of the kicker, they're all flat-footed. They wait for the guy to catch the ball, and then they have to gravitate to a certain area or something like that. But in the meantime, they're all 1-1-1-1-1. So if you've got a guy who could break tackles like a Cordell Patterson, and Pittsburgh was ahead of the curve, they didn't wait. As soon as the kickoff rule was established, Pittsburgh signed Cordell Patterson within, 24 hours of the rule? And then you're going to look at these one-cut guys, and I think what we're going to see is that seventh-round kick returners are going to go in the fifth round for certain teams because they think they could break open a game. I think field position, instead of starting at the 25, is going to start at the 30 or 35 in a lot of cases, and I think you're going to see some big runs. I posted something right away where if you're going to get a kickoff artist, you have to kick at a certain distance, which is weird to begin with. You can't bounce it. But if you can get a line drive kicker that can just nail it where there's a possibility that it goes right through the end zone, but it doesn't start in the end zone, as I understand the rule, then the ball comes out to the 20, which is worse than before, if it can get past everybody. Don't quote me on that, but that's what I think I remembered. And Steve Fezzik saw my tweet on that, and he put that out and confirmed it. He said, yes, that's what they should be looking for. So there's a lot of strategy going in, and there's certain types of players that I would target to be that return specialist. And then there's going to be certain types of players that I would have to target to be the guys that protect their turf.
Might also be worth targeting certain types of coaches, even if they're a bit devious. As long as they're detailed enough, there could be some edges to be had. And this will be a 10-second detour of mine that might alienate most of the audience, but some might get a kick out of it. For anybody else who grew up on Super Mario Kart, Ron, as I think of players who can just get really quick acceleration or break tackles being more valuable than returners in the past who might have taken a while to get up to speed, but once they got to that top gear, their top-end speed was unmatched. Maybe in this new era, we're thinking more players like Yoshi with the really quick acceleration, or Toad's character in Super Mario Kart, where he had really nifty handling, as opposed to somebody like a Bowser who had elite top end speed, but it took too long to get there given the confines of the new NFL kickoff rules.
Yeah, one so cut, Ron, and you're gone. That's what you're looking for.
Yeah, and that is it for this week's and probably this year's segment of Super Mario Kart. But I would like to carry on to wrap this up beyond all things NFL. On a personal note, I know that you and your wife are power travelers, and as of this conversation last year, you'd been to 47 states. The final three that you mentioned, Oklahoma, Minnesota, North Dakota, you stated your goal was to have been to all 50 states by May of 2024. Fast forward to today, May of 2024 is knocking at the door. So how's that final countdown looking to have gotten to all 50 states?
This is a very sore subject, Matt. I'm going to let you down. I'm still at 47. It's basically 20, it's been 5 years in a holding pattern. I think I'll find a way to get to Oklahoma, fly there for some festival or something. Minnesota, North Dakota, I'd like to do more. I mean, there's a lot to see in terms of hiking, I think, in the back roads and a lot of stuff. I'd like to do that. Matt, I understand there's something called Bed Bash in August. Last year, it was Iceland. We had predetermined that we were going to Iceland, and we had a wonderful time. We talked about that in the past. So I have to say, Bed Bash, North Dakota, Minnesota. Bed Bash, North Dakota, Minnesota. So I'm probably looking at next year for North Dakota and Minnesota.
Yeah, Bed Bash in that scale, I can see where a pre-planned trip to Iceland had to take precedence, but hopefully Bed Bash will take precedent this time around. And Ron, not a lot of progress to share this year with regard to the travel plans. When we circle back in the future, we'll see how much you have checked off the list. But I bet an area where you might have some more promising updates to report, let's go ahead and weave in a pillar of this show, the hops. Now, full disclosure, no beer on hand for me tonight. I told you this, Ron, before we started to record. I have had a lot of focus on the hops on the show the last couple of weeks, but I'm trying to be kind to my liver this week before I'm not as kind to it next week when I'll be in Vegas for a bachelor party. So that said, I'm happy to turn the segment over to you. And knowing you as a fan of dark beer, the Montrose Craft Beer Fest, which I recapped on last week's episode. My first beer was a dark beer called Jewel City by Brew Yard Beer Company based in Glendale, California. And the style was one that I think might interest you. It was a California Common. That's in the same vein as Anchor Steam, RIP Anchor Brewing, which was a San Francisco landmark. When a lot of people hear dark beer, they think of styles like stouts or porters. Ron, do you have any familiarity with the California Common, also known as the steam beer style?
I do not, actually.
All right, so that's a fun one. Maybe I'm going to give you a homework assignment here, and then I'll see what else you care to share about your latest adventures in dark beer. But it is definitely lighter in ABV than most stouts or porters that you'll find. It has a nice caramel malt, so it's got a good backbone. The ABV is typically in the range of maybe an IPA or a pale ale in the 5 or 6% range. So I feel like it's not quite as sessionable as, let's say, a Guinness, but it's a lot more palatable than what some people may perceive a barrel-aged adjunct-infused stout or even a heavier porter. So it's a pretty iconic style. Anchor Steam was just an iconic beer in California for the longest time.
Right.
And the California Common, still alive and well in some parts. So if you can get your hands on one, I'd recommend it. And maybe we can get a report on a future episode of Props and Hops.
Yeah. So I was down in San Diego in the downtown area at the Mike Hess Brewing Company. Don't know if you're familiar with that one, but they had quite a lot of people there, and they had a pretty good choice of dark beers. So I got a Hooligan, which apparently is a stout Irish dry, 5%. So it wasn't very much. I don't, the bitterness, the IPU was at 37. I wish I knew, what my bitterness taste is, but if those who know that and judge that, it's at a 37. It went down very smooth. If I wasn't driving all the way back that same night, I would have probably engaged in a little bit more than just one. But it was a very nice tasting beer. And at 5%, it was very drinkable.
Yeah, and I'm doing some real-time research, and it looks like most mass-market lagers, think Bud Light, Coors Light, they're in the range of 5 to 10 IBUs, which is an international bitterness unit. A lot of beers that start to get more bitter, according to most people, think pale ales or hoppy beers known to be bitter, they can be in the range of 55 to 70 IBUs. So it sounded like you kind of threaded the needle with a nice middle ground there and probably quite balanced. I don't know which Mike Hess Brewing location you visited, but if I'm recalling correctly, there's one in Seaport Village down in San Diego that shares a space with a taco shop, and you are right on the water. It is one of the most beautiful places I've ever been to in my life. Add good tacos and good beer to the equation, and you might as well have died and gone to heaven.
In just a few seconds, I will talk more about that.
All right. I can't wait any longer. Go for it.
Well, it's because, you set it up because it's your Malinsky minute.
Oh, I see where we're going. Okay, there we go. Thank you. So the audience catching this live, I'm not even going to wipe this. That was my mistake. We'll reset just a bit here. Pretend like we just rewound 10 seconds and you set me up to speak to it in a few seconds. And this will be an opportunity to weave in the Malinsky Minute to this week's episode. And I think this is a special time to do it because this past Sunday, April 14th, marked 6 years since Dave's untimely passing. And I took a moment on Sunday to read through some of his remarkable photo essays he'd put together from his adventures on Mount Charleston, exploring bristlecone pine trees, to which he referred as his old friends in high places. And one quote and one photo I came across from Dave's work stood out. I posted that on Twitter this past weekend. The quote was, "Sometimes we take what is living for granted. This earth that we are privileged to be a part of is simply too precious for us to do that." So to bring this conversation full circle, Ron, it's not just the bears who are on the clock. I feel like the clock is ticking on all of us in a sense. And with the right perspective, acknowledging this can be much more of a positive than a negative. So here's the tee up. In the spirit of Dave's quote, what's one thing that you're currently trying to be more intentional about appreciating these days?
So I thought about a lot of things I could put here, but I think I put the right one here, even though I never met Dave. in all my travels to Vegas, I was not in that crowd. Of course, I always traveled solo and secretive for years and years and years until being more open and finding people such as yourself over the last few years. But I know he had a love for hiking. I know, based on some of the episodes I've heard from you, that he liked the outdoors. He liked to appreciate some of the finer things. And that's, I forgot how wonderful it is to just go and reconnect with old friends and old colleagues. And I was invited to an event in San Diego at Seaport Village and to reunite with people I hadn't seen in anywhere from 5 to 15 years. So at this event, there were some different presentations, and there was lunch, and there was a chance for happy hour at the Mike Hess Brewing Company. But a lot of it was just sitting in a group of people that I hadn't seen for a while, but we acted like we had seen each other yesterday, and we were just chatting, and time was going by. And I don't wear a watch. In fact, I've never worn a watch. Nowadays, with cell phones, you can find the time anywhere. But even before cell phones, I never wore a watch. The reason I say this is because when you're sitting and just shooting the breeze with old friends, people you haven't seen for a while, time shouldn't matter. You shouldn't be worried about what your next appointment is, or let's get back here, or I've got to do the dishes, or this or that, or whatever. Time should be spent with those people that you haven't seen and that you cherish. And I've moved away from some of friends as well. And I appreciate the time when we get together at a winery or something like that. So my Molinsky Minute is basically to do more of these, to reconnect with old friends, to shoot the breeze, and to not worry about time. Let it stand still and just appreciate that.
That is so well said. I could imagine Dave just being over the moon with the way you laid that out. And having gotten lunch with him a few times, it took me a bit to realize he embodied that ethos so well. I think anytime anybody got lunch or dinner with Dave, it wasn't a 1 hour appointment. This was several hours. I think there was one lunch. I remember meeting up with Dave along with my wife, Allison, and my big brother, Bobby, and I must have gone out to feed a meter. I thought we were just going to have an hour of Dave's precious time, and I just took a spot on the street with a meter. I think I fed it 3 or 4 different times because Dave just wanted to keep hanging out and talking about anything other than sports or anything other than betting. His curiosity and other people, his well-roundedness just really made time fly. So I really appreciate the way you laid that out. It's always a segment I look forward to on these shows, but that's one of the most special ones I think we've put together, coming up on close to 300 episodes now. So thank you, Ron. That was very well done.
The fact that you put that out in a lot of your shows and you make us think about that is much appreciated as well.
I can't think of a better note than that on which to wrap up. I want to remind everybody, you can go ahead and follow Ron on Twitter at Ron A Sports. Ron, it's always a blast to catch up. Thank you for another excellent conversation.
Thanks for having me. I know we'll be doing more in the future. I'm sure I'll be talking and writing about the draft over the next couple weeks. And then I'll try to get to some of these places that, maybe not those states, but we do have travel plans, and no better time to do that in the summertime.
Yeah, unless it's August when Bet Bash is taking place. So hopefully I will see you there. In the meantime, want to also take a moment to thank everybody for watching and listening to this week's episode. Heads up, I'll be back next week with another deep dive on the NFL draft betting market to wrap up the 2024 Plug and Play series. I'm planning to stream live on Tuesday night next week and publish the podcast by Wednesday morning, in order to extend the shelf life prior to round one beginning on Thursday. On that note, everybody, thanks again for tuning in, and I'll catch you next week right back here on Props and Hops.